My name is Ernie Cook, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, y'all. I may or may not get a ribbon tomorrow that says speaker. The jury's still out. That was a very kind introduction, Mike. I appreciate that very much. There was a time in my life when I had to be explained, and it's kind of nice to be introduced rather than explained. Because I'd always hear just before I walked in the room, "Well, you know how Ernie is." That wasn't good. It's a real privilege and a pleasure for me to be a part of the 20th annual roundup. It was my pleasure 9 years ago when I was 4 years sober to be the voice of the roundup, like John is today. And unfortunately, at 4 years, see, y'all's timing has been a little bad. Because at 4 years, I knew one hell of a lot more than I know today. I could have told y'all everything there is to know about Alcoholics Anonymous at 4 years. But as time goes by, it seems to work that I find out that there's less and less that I know about this program, but more and more that I'm grateful for about this program. I'll never forget during the course of that, I don't only suffer from alcoholism, I also suffer from big shotism. And when I was asked to be the voice of the roundup, I was at the height of my big shotness in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought I had arrived. And so they brought me over here, and they gave me that little book like they did John, and told me to stick to the book, and of course I didn't. And I entertained the group for every night that I could, for as long as they didn't give me the hook. I'd stand up here and entertain them. And I should never forget, by Saturday night, nobody had told me what a wonderful job I was doing. And so Mama and I over here in a room someplace, and I'm lying there in the bed, and I just can't stand it any longer. I got to have somebody give me some positive reinforcement, A big shot's got to feel like a big shot sometimes. And so I rolled over, and I said, "Mama, how am I doing?" And she looked at me and said, "What difference does it make if you work in your program?" I said, "Thank you, God." It is a pleasure for me to be here, and there's a lot of folks out here who heard my story, and it's always tempting to change it and try to be a little more entertaining. Don W. tells me that there's three stories. There's the one you tell going, and there's the one you tell while you're there, and there's the one you wish you had told when you leave, and the one you told while you're there is the worst one. But it's also the most honest one, damn it. None of them are 100% honest, but at least it gets a little bit honest. When I take my watch off like that and put it down, I'm reminded of the story. I grew up down in South Georgia, and everybody in South Georgia is a Southern Baptist. I think if you ain't Southern Baptist, you just hell bound. I mean, that's the way it is down there. And it seems that in the fourth grade down there one day, a little Baptist boy and a little Catholic boy got to be good friends. And a little Catholic boy invited a little Baptist boy to go home with him on the weekend. And they had a great day Friday and a great day Saturday, and they went to Mass on Sunday morning. And they were sitting there in Mass, and they started going through the rituals that the Catholic Church goes through. And little Baptist boy didn't understand it, and he kept saying, "What does that mean? What does that mean?" Little Catholic boy, he'd explain it to him. So as luck would have it, the next weekend, a little Baptist boy invited a little Catholic boy to come home and spend the weekend with him. And he came over, and they went to the Baptist church on Sunday morning. And after they had done the most important thing they do at the Baptist church, they'd pass the basket. Sang the benediction. The preacher walked up in the pulpit, took his watch off, and laid it down on the podium in the pulpit, just about like I did right here. And little Catholic boy nudged the little Baptist boy and said, "What does that mean?" Little Baptist boy said, "Not a damn thing." Boy, you give a drunk a microphone, you got trouble every time. I guarantee it. Yeah. It just happens that way. But I have to to do all the statistics first. If the God of my understanding allows me to live to the last day of this month, I'll be 60 years old. I was born on July 31st, 1935. My sobriety date is May 2nd, 1982. I've celebrated 13 years of wonderful sobriety in the God-given program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my home group is the Skyland Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the best group there is in the world. And if you don't believe yours is, then by God, you better find another group. Yeah. And when I talk about Mama in my story, I'm not talking about my maternal Mama. I'm talking about my wife. And for you Al-Anons get up in arms, it has no psychological undertones whatsoever. I do not look at Mama as a Mama figure, but at my house, since I found it not necessary to take a drink all the time, she calls me Dad and I call her Mama, and that beats the hell out of what she used to call me. And I used to wouldn't call her because I didn't want to see her, you know. It was trouble in River City when every time she showed up. With all that behind us, I guess it's time for me to begin to tell you what it used to be like and what happened and what Ernie's like today. As I said, I was born in 1935, and I was born in July, and the God-given program of Alcoholics Anonymous was instituted in June of that same year. And my alcoholic ego wants me to believe that Dr. Bob and Bill saw me coming, and they wanted to have a place for me when I got here. I was born to two school teachers. My dad was a high school principal. My mom taught the first grade for some 44 years, and I don't need to tell you a whole lot more to tell you that I grew up in a very structured household. And in the process of growing up in that household, I began to develop the character defects that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous with me. Because, you see, it's important for me to remember that the character defects that I had before I had my first drink, I had while I was drinking, and I still have with me today. And that I work on them one day at a time with the help of people like you and the God of my understanding to try to rid myself of those same character defects. Because you've told me that it's important that I remember that it's not alcohol that made me what I am today, but what I am made me drink alcohol. And you see, I grew up in that little modest home down there in Columbus, Georgia, and we didn't have much. And I immediately began to resent the fact that other kids had more than I had. So I began to have resentments early on in my life. I also was forced to go to school where my dad was principal and my mom taught, and that was not a good situation for them, and it wasn't a good situation for me. I had blonde, curly hair and blue eyes, and my peers just didn't like blonde, curly-headed, blue-eyed principal sons, I'll tell you that. And, of course, growing up in that school, I tried everything I could to please everybody that I could. I wanted everybody to always love me, and y'all taught me since I've come into this wonderful program that there ain't but two things wrong with that. One is everybody, and the other one's always. Because everybody ain't always going to like Ernie. And I understand that today. But I didn't understand that back then. And so I began to try to put up all these facades and try to be all these different people. And I tried to be what my parents wanted me to be, which was a good student. I tried to be what the guys that seemed like they were having a good time in school were doing. Except I wouldn't walk all the way over the line because I knew I'd get the hell beat out of me if I did. And I also wanted to be the people that got the accolades and got the honors and all those things. And in trying to be three different things at one time, I was absolutely nothing. And it was a long, long time before I ever began to develop any kind of identity whatsoever because I was spending so much time trying to please so many people and nobody would accept me and I became a part of nothing. And I know many of you have felt that same empty feeling when you could walk into a room full of people and you felt alone. And that's the way I felt, but I didn't let you know that. Because you see, I was a class clown and I did all those things to hide all those feelings and to make you believe that I didn't really care. Because as long as you thought I didn't care, then you couldn't hurt my feelings, but you really could. But I'd never let you know that. But I grew up in that atmosphere, and I grew up in that Southern Baptist church, and I was scared to death of God, and I was scared of my daddy, and I was scared of girls. Not necessarily in that order. See, I had God and my daddy mixed up. I thought they were about one and the same, because that Southern Baptist God was vengeful and scorekeeping, and those are the things that I chose to hear. And if a Southern Baptist in the room, I'm not knocking the religion. I'm just telling you that's what this alcoholic chose to hear in that Baptist church, was it? God's going to get you for this, and he's going to get you for that. And thou shalt do this, and thou shalt not do that. And by the time I was 12 years old, and I was in the church there one day, and the preacher said, if you've thought about it, you've done it. I said, I'm hell bound. Might as well go ahead and do it, baby. If you've thought about it, you've done it. Boy, what a crushing blow that was, I'm telling you. Well, I grew up there in that atmosphere, and I had a lot of resentments. I had a great deal of fear. Boy, I was scared of everything. And I never will forget, it was deemed when I was still in the womb that I'd go to the University of Georgia, because that's where my daddy went. And Mom and Daddy scrimped and saved and did everything they could to put together enough money for me to go off to the University of Georgia. And I never forget when they took me up there and left me. There I was, a 19-year-old kid who, A, had never spent a night away from home in his life except at his grandmama's and his granddaddy's. B, had never stayed up past 12 o'clock a day in his life. And C, that didn't know doodly squat about what was going on in the world. And you talking about scared. I was scared. And it took me 3 years at the University of Georgia to realize that there was nobody up there seeing what I was doing. Slow learner, guys. Slow learner. Hell, I went to class. I went to church. I went to bed by myself. I did all the things that I was supposed to do, because I didn't realize there was nobody there to see what I was doing. And in my third year up at the university, I hurt my leg playing intramural ball. And I'll never forget it, because I was sitting there on the couch in the fraternity house one Saturday morning, and the guys came by and jokingly said, Big E, let's go get a beer. They knew I didn't drink, you know. And I thought to myself, you know, I've been here 3 years, and these guys have been drinking for 3 years, and God ain't done nothing to them. I believe I'll give this a try. I had my leg in a cast at the time, because back then I thought I was an athlete. Today it's obvious that I wasn't, but I thought I was. And I had my leg in a cast, and they got me in my cast and took me out to a place in Athens, and for those of you who might have been there a long time ago, to a place called Harry's, right in the little Five Points in Athens, and they say that I drank six tall Budweisers. Now, I have no idea. But I know one thing. Boy, howdy. Boy, them six Budweisers took an eraser and erased N-E-R-D off my chest, you know. And put S-U-P-E-R across there. And I knew I had arrived somewhere in the course of those six Budweisers. And my fraternity brothers, the campus wasn't nearly as big as it is now. It weren't but about 5,000 people there. My fraternity brothers decided they'd take me out and show me off, because everybody knew I didn't drink. So they took me around all the sorority houses in Athens to show me off. And they say that I put on quite a show now. You know, some of the things I did were very bizarre back then. You know, today, hell, they live together over there, so it wouldn't be bizarre today. But they say I went in these sorority houses and I went upstairs. You just didn't go upstairs in sorority houses back then. And they say I came back downstairs with some women's under things, you know. And if I did, that was the first time I'd ever seen them in person. I knew what page they were on in the Sears and Roebuck catalog, but... I had never seen them for real, you know. Anyhow, to make a long story short, they took me back to the fraternity house, and I got sick and passed out. And of course, I was in a blackout from about whatever beer on. And I woke up the next morning and felt like the wrath of God and cut one of the first of thousands of deals with God. God, if you just get me, make me feel better, I won't ever do this again. I know it was bad and I know I was wrong. And Lordy, I wish I hadn't done it. But my fraternity brothers, being the nice guys they were, they came up to me and said, Ernie, said, there ain't but one way to get to feeling better. And I said, what's that? They said, what you need is a little vodka and orange juice. I said, well, pour me one. And they poured me a vodka and orange juice, and I drank it, and I felt better. And I drank another one, and I felt good. And I drank another one, and I felt wonderful. And the telephone rang. And it was for me. Well, everybody thought it was my mom and daddy. I've been there 3 years. Ain't nobody ever called me but my mom and my daddy. I went to the telephone, and some of these little sorority girls, some of these sorority houses, said, Ernie, said, where's all that personality been all these years? And I thought to myself, look ahead. Because, see, I had them three Viking oranges, and I was personality plus. And I talked to them on the telephone, you know, and I began to have a social life. Started dating a majorette up at the University of Georgia, one of the prettiest little ladies on the campus, just a beautiful lady, still is today. Started dating her. I dated her three times and gave her my fraternity pin, a little bizarre, but I gave it to her. Dated her three or four more times and asked her to marry me. Hell, do you think that's funny? She said yes. Yeah. Smart woman, but no common sense. Yeah, you see, the reason why I asked her to marry me were three things. First of all, she was a beautiful lady, and I really did love her. And I was real proud that all of a sudden, here I am seen with a good-looking woman. And for a guy that ain't been close to a woman in his life, it was a new experience for me. And the second thing was, I realized I was about to graduate from the University of Georgia, and I didn't have doodly squat about what I was going to do out there. I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't know how to rent an apartment. I didn't know how to turn the lights on, do any of those things. And I needed somebody to help me with that. And the third thing was, I knew this woman ain't never seen me sober. If she ever saw me sober and found out what a nerd I really was, she's going to throw me overboard, so I better get her while I was still drunk. Anyhow, she agreed to marry me, and God sent that wonderful lady three omens about that marriage. She didn't pay any attention to any of them. First thing that happened was I got my leg out of the cast, and then I re-injured it. They put it back in a cast, and the doctor said he'd take it out for one day, and I could walk down the aisle, and then he'd put it back in the day after the wedding, and she said that'd be okay, we'd do that, and I said okay. Second thing that happened exactly 1 week prior to the time that we would be married, on March the 15th, 1957. I was at home, and I had my leg in a cast, so I couldn't cut the grass. My dad was out cutting the grass, and heard my mama scream, and I went out in the backyard on my crutches, and I saw my dad lying there in the grass, and I knew when I saw him lying there that he had gone to the other room. And I don't like to talk about this because I'm not proud of the feelings that I had that day. Because you see, here's a man that a lot of things had transpired between he and I. The first thing was that there was very little love and affection shown in our home, and I'm not blaming anybody for that because I sure as hell wasn't showing much. But there was very little love and affection shown in that home because I believe today that my daddy was a closet alcoholic, and I have no right to say whether he was or not, but I believe in my heart today that he was a closet alcoholic. He was the president of the Civitan Club, and he was the principal of the school, and he was a deacon in the Winning Road Baptist Church in Columbus, Georgia, and he was all the things that you're supposed to be in the community. But every night when daddy came home in various and sundry locations around the house, he had these square bottles of London Distilled Dry Gin, Gilby's London Distilled Dry Gin. And he kind of get down in those bottles when he get home every night. And the further he got down into those bottles, the less wonderful personality he had. And he and Mama would get to talking to each other, and they weren't loving tones. And I can remember lying in the bed and hearing them talk to each other. And I can remember how afraid Mama and I were that they were going to find out that he was drinking, and he was going to lose his job, of course. And that even though we didn't have much, we were going to lose what we had. I mean, very selfish reasons why I felt that. But there this man was, and he had made every decision in my life. He decided what clothes I was going to wear, what courses I took in high school, what college I was going to, what girls I dated, what time I'd be home, where I would go, what sports I would play. Everything in my life had been planned by this man. And I looked at him lying down on the ground, and I couldn't help but feel like Martin Luther King standing on the mountaintop. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. And you see, with him there, and I realized, and I took control of my life. Ernie Cook took control of his life on March the 15th, 1957. And as this story goes on, you'll find out what one hell of a mess I made out of it. But I took control. And the second feeling that I had being a good old drunk, second feeling that I had was people are really going to feel sorry for me. Now my dad has died and people are going to feel sorry for me. And they're going to come up and they're going to hug my neck and they're going to tell me how much they love me. And I wanted that. And I was willing to pay any price for that. And those are the feelings I had. None of the warm feelings of a son for a father who had made all these sacrifices so that his life could be better than his own. But these very selfish attitudes that I had as he lay down on the ground. But this little lady decided that even though Daddy had passed away, that we'd still get married on that next Saturday. On the morning we were to be wed, she came down with the mumps. Went to the doctor and he told her she could go down the aisle and then she'd have to go back home. Nothing changed in my life. And she decided that we'd go ahead and we'd do that. So we sent her three omens and she ignored all three of them and we went down the aisle. It looked something like Chester and the Chipmunks going down the aisle. There, you know? I was dragging one leg and she was kind of puffed up, you know. Wedding pictures are a sight, I'm sure. Or they were, I'm sure they're all destroyed by now, but they were a sight. Well, we got married, and we went back and we finished that year at the university, and we came to Atlanta to live because that's where her parents lived, and I went out and found a job, and I worked at that company for 37 years, retired a little over a year ago. I worked at the same company for 37 years, and I used to tell people from the podium I never lost a job, but you see, that was a lie. So I lost a lot of jobs. See, the folks that came to work for that company in 1957 like I did, those folks got airplanes today and houses in several places and boats and all kinds of material possessions and have gone on to bigger and better things. So I lost a lot of jobs as a result of my alcoholism. But I don't tell you that for you to feel sorry for me, and I certainly don't mean for you to do that. I tell you that because it's important that I be honest with you. Because yeah, I believe with all my heart that I'm right where I'm supposed to be tonight and right where I was meant to be tonight. And I also believe I had to do everything that I did to get where I am. You know, I feel a lot like the former Secretary of the Interior. Prior to the time that he went to the Secretary of Interior, he was a managing an Indian reservation before he was promoted to the Secretary of Interior. He said when he found out about his promotion, the Indians decided they were going to have a big party for him. And so they got on the reservation and they had this big, all the Indian foods and went through all the Indian customs and paid him all these honors and all these accolades. He said, but the most wonderful thing that I've ever had said to me and the biggest honor that I've ever had was done by an older Indian lady. Said she walked up to me at that ceremony that night and she very simply said, I like me best when I'm with you. I like me best when I'm with you. I like me best when I'm with you because I'm closer to the God of my understanding when I'm with you. I like me best when I'm with you because I know you love me warts and all. I like me best when I'm with you because I know you love me enough that when I get out of line, you'll let me know. And when I start believing my own stuff, you'll tap me on the shoulder and say, you full of it again. You're doing it again. But I sincerely like me best when I'm with you. You see, I was 47 years old before I ever felt like I was where I was supposed to be, and it was at the Skyland Group on a Christmas ceremony one night. We were having a Christmas ceremony, candlelight ceremony, and we were going around the room. 47 years old, the first time I ever felt like I was where I was supposed to be. 47 years old. Ever since that night, every time I'm in a group of alcoholics like y'all, knowing the God of my understanding is right here with us, I know I'm where I'm supposed to be. I like me best when I'm with you. That first day I was at that job, lunchtime came and the guy said, "Big E, let's go eat some lunch." And I said, "That sounds good to me." And I started out to the cafeteria and they laughed. And they said, "Ernie, nobody eats in the cafeteria." There's a little place across the street over here. Guess what the name of it was? Harry's Famous Steakhouse. Said, "We all go over there for lunch." We went over for lunch and we drank 6 or 7 beers. Came back to work and I knew I had found my profession for life. And sure enough, I had. Because they didn't run me off. So I worked there and this marriage began to go downhill. And it started to go downhill because my alcoholism was beginning to progress and I wasn't doing very well. And you know, they tell us, and I know today, that alcoholism is the only disease in the world that A, tells me I ain't got it. And it's the only disease in the world that B, kills folks that don't have it. Because you see, I believe that there are people here in this room that got a lot worse side of the deal than I did in alcoholism. Because I know there's some Al-Anons and some friends and some loved ones here in this room that have put up with an alcoholic for a long, long time. And I believe you got the bad end of the deal. Because you see, 90% of the time, I was totally out of it, didn't know what was happening, and your alcoholic was that same way. But my little pretty majorette wife began to get sick, just like I was. And she began to do the very same things that an alcoholic does. She decided if we bought a house, things would get better, and we bought a house and things got worse. And they got worse because that house was further from my favorite watering hole than where we had lived before. So that meant I was more prone to get DUIs and other various and sundry things that happened on the way home. You know, you never knew. It was always an experience. And then she decided if we had a child, things would get better. And she had one of the most beautiful little blind-headed youngins you ever saw in your life. And things got worse. And to show you that they're just like alcoholics and that they suffer from this very same disease, she decided that she'd do the same thing again and expect different results. And she said if we had a second child, things would get better. And we had another little girl, and things got worse. 2 beautiful children, a majorette for a wife, a little house out there in Decatur, paid $13,500 for. Sure, hell, wish I had it today. $89 a month house payment. I mean, you know, everything was going wonderful, but I discovered big shotism. I got out in the world and I found some people that were doing some things that looked like fun. They were dating women that weren't their wives. They were betting on football games and baseball games. They were playing poker. They were doing all this stuff that looked like fun, but it required money. And I didn't have any. But you see, by this time, this company had made a major mistake. They had put me on an expense account. And I started stealing money. Ooh, law. And when I couldn't steal enough, what I'd do is I'd get in my car. And see, by this time, my mama, who's now 87 years old, taught that first grade for 44 years, she'd retired. She was living on teacher retirement, probably about $400 a month. And when I ran out of money, I'd get in my car and I'd drive down to Columbus, Georgia, and I'd tell Mama a sad story about what the baby needed or about the house or some lie like that. And she'd give me $300 or $400 and I'd come back to Atlanta and I'd be a big shot for 1 or 2 more nights. And I thought that was okay because, you see, alcohol kept telling me that was okay. You see, I had a hell of a time ever believing that alcohol was the problem because alcohol was always the solution for me. It was always the answer. It always told me that what I was doing was all right. And that's why I had such a tough time with it. But that's what happens, and is when you get out there in the streets, you know, you find these women that they can, you know, they can make you change your mind about things. I mean, you know, they got the hammer. They really do. And so I ran into a little lady, and all of a sudden she was about 10 years younger than that majorette. That majorette's had two young'uns by now, and she ain't looking like a majorette anymore. So drunk Ernie decides it's time to upgrade. Yeah. Folks, I ain't proud of this now. I decided it was time to upgrade, so I decided I'd leave that beautiful little majorette, that wonderful lady, and those two little girls, and that little house over there in Decatur. But you know, I was damn sure I had overlap. You always got to have overlap. Don't ever go with a woman that ain't got a house, a car, and some furniture, you know. Don't ever, because you got to have a place to go when you leave that first place. So I had overlap. I'll never forget the day that I left that wonderful lady and those two little girls. We were out there in Decatur in that little house, and as I started to walk out of that house that day with the clothes on my back, my golf clubs, and a 65 Mustang, that's about 5 years into that marriage, a lady came to work where I was working. It was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen inside and out. But she was also one of the smartest women I'd ever met. And I made it up in my mind that if I could somehow finagle this woman and be in mine, that everything would be okay. So I got out the big guns, and I'd become very suave and deboner by now. And I gave her my ever-loving best shot, but there was one thing wrong with this woman. She was a hell of a lot smarter than what I'd been dealing with. She wouldn't give me the time of day. Wouldn't give me the time of day. But I was very persistent, because she was pretty. Very persistent, and finally I convinced her that if she would get out of her arrangement, I would get out of my arrangement, and we would get together. Now, there are folks here in this room are not going to believe what I'm about to say, but see, I believe with all my heart that I was going to change my way of living when she and I got married. I believed that I was going to stop doing the things that I was doing. I believed it with all my heart. And I know there are a lot of folks out there that don't believe that. And you probably didn't believe that from your drunk, whoever it might be. But I can tell you that there comes a time in our lives when we no longer have a choice. And there's not but one place in this world where I can find relief from that, and that's right here in rooms like this. But we decided that, and the second thing was she had a little boy, and I'd always thought if I had a little boy to go fishing with and carry the football games and do all these wonderful things with, things would be better. See, I just had a little girl. If I just had me a little boy. So she was bringing a built-in little boy to this marriage, and I just knew everything was going to be okay. Well, I thought I stayed pretty straight for a week, but she said it was about 3 or 4 days. And if there's anything I've learned in 13 years, and Al Anon's always right. So for 3 or 4 days, I didn't drink anything but Annie Green Springs and Boone Farm. And just a little Mad Dog that she didn't know about. I called myself staying sober. And then at the end of some period of time, I decided I'd go by my old watering hole and have one drink, and that day I did. But I went back the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And 2 weeks into that marriage, I was doing the very same thing with her I've been doing with the other two ladies. Very same thing. All the love in the world could not make me change what I was doing. And she put up with that for 9 years, and 9 years into that marriage, a couple things started happening. Place I'd been working at that time for 25 years started making some sounds like it might be a good idea if I thought about leaving early. At home, I got to feeling like I was supposed to already been gone. There were a lot of folks looking for me. The bookies were looking for me. There were some ladies in Atlanta looking for me. There were some husbands in Atlanta looking for me. And I was looking for a place to hide. I didn't tell y'all, but 3 years prior to this, one of my best friends, a guy that we'd been through divorces together and run the street together and drank liquor together and did all those kinds of things together. 3 years prior to that, he had gone into a treatment center, and I knew he weren't drinking anymore. And I chose not to speak to him for 3 years. Because I sure didn't want his wife talking to my wife. And so John was in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, of course. And one place in there, I decided I was going to quit drinking again. And I think I hadn't had a drink for probably 12 or 14 hours, and I was vibrating. And you know, when you're going through one of those periods when you're trying to make mama happy, not only you're not drinking, but you're doing all the things that you're supposed to have done for the last 6 months. And I'm trying to hang a door down at my place. Well, John lives 100 yards from me, and I ain't spoken to him in 3 years. And he happens by while I'm trying to hang his door. Now, trying to get a screwdriver on a screw when you ain't had a drink for 12 hours is a piece of work. Make a long story short, he hung the door for me. And you see, by now, John knew the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and this program of attraction and not promotion. He said, "Ernie, if you need me, just call me." That's all he said. Didn't say a word about drinking. Just said, "If you need me, just call me." And he went back to his house and he told his lovely wife, Helen, "It won't be long now." And sure enough, it wasn't. Okay, see, all these things were closing in. I wanted a place to hide, and I went into treatment center for all the wrong reasons. All the wrong reasons. Had my last drink. Big Ray took it away from me as I walked through the double doors at the back of the treatment center. Never forget. Had no intention of stopping drinking, but I sure didn't need a place to hide for about a month. In that treatment center, the first morning I woke up, I looked down at the end of the hall. I thought I saw somebody I recognized, and I walked down there and I said, "Are you who I think you are?" And he said, "I am if you who I think you are." It was my second wife's second husband. We were in detox together. Well, when they found out about it, they decided it's going to be the damnedest confrontation here you ever saw in your life. So they whisked him off to the other side. But after a few days, I got over to the other side, and we got together, and we had a great time. We spent 28 days taking that woman's inventory. We decided she had driven us both to drink. But it was in that hospital about my second week that I began to listen to what the people were saying in there. And I had a moment of clarity when old Joe T, and I don't think Joe's here tonight, but when old Joe T had been to 17 institutions, including Milledgeville, twice for alcoholism. And he was in there at the same time I was, and they were fixing to ship him off to Huberlin Colony up in North Carolina. And before that man left, he came in. You know, you know how close you get in a treatment center. I don't think you get closer to people in the world than you get in a treatment center. And he walked in and sat down on the edge of my bed. He put his arm around my neck and he hugged me and he said, "Ernie, I'm going to tell you something." He said, "It may register, it may not. But you don't have to go through all the stuff I've been through if you just listen to what these people tell you." I have no idea why I listened to that, but I did. Joe went off to Huberlin College, been sober ever since. God love him. I started going to morning meditation the next day, and it was in that morning meditation that I found the God of my understanding that I have today. Now, whether or not that's the same God that I had in the Southern Baptist Church, it don't make any difference anymore. I don't have to analyze that. I don't have to question that. I don't have to know whether that's the same God or not. All I know is that I found the God of my understanding right there in that treatment center in that morning meditation. And the difference was that it wasn't vengeful and scorekeeping, but it was a helpful, loving, patient God with a hell of a sense of humor that when I mess up, he just looks down and shakes his head and says, "Hey, boy, I don't know about him. You know, I don't know about him." You see, I believe today that God sees me as he'd like for me to be, but he loves me just like I am. And ain't that wonderful to feel that way? Ain't it wonderful to feel that way after you've always thought that God was out to get you? That he sees me like he wants me to be, and he loves me just like I am. He loves me when I'm good, and he loves me when I'm bad. He ain't proud of me when I'm bad, but he loves me. He knows, you know, he knows I'm bad to the bone. Yeah. See, there are a lot of folks that will tell you God picks and chooses. I don't believe God picks and chooses. I believe God's grace is like sunshine and rain, and it falls on us just like sunshine and rain, and it's what I do with God's grace that determines what my destiny is. He don't pick and choose for me to have a good day or a bad day. He doesn't pick and choose for me to make money or not make money. He doesn't pick and choose for me to buy a big car or a little car or to walk with a fast walking cane. He doesn't make those choices. His grace falls on me like sunshine and rain. If there's anybody out there today that's having a difficult time finding God, please borrow mine. Because I believe you'd like him, and I know he'd like you. And I just don't believe we can make it in this God-given program without a conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves. But it was there I found a God of my understanding. I got out of that treatment center, and I wish I could tell you that things were just sailing, but they weren't. You see, while I was in there, I picked up that white chip to impress my counselor there in the treatment center. I picked up a silver chip because, see, John B. had personally assigned himself as my sponsor just as soon as I got in there. So he came and picked me up the day I got out of that treatment center, and I picked up a silver chip to impress him. 90 days in the program, I was over at Skyler, my home group, and Annette was still a counselor at the treatment center, and she said, "Ernie, would you do me a favor?" I said, "Sure, Annette." She said, "Would you go back and get one of the bands and bring them over?" I said, "I'll be happy to." So I went over and got the band, brought it back over to Skyler, and the meeting got over, and I said, Annette. She said, "Yeah." I said, "Who am I supposed to take home?" She said, "The same people you brought over here." Still sick, y'all. I didn't bring anybody. Been riding in that van for 29 days. Didn't bring anybody. Just brought the van. Brought the van. Yeah. 6 months sober, I was in Greenville, South Carolina. I was back traveling on the road by then. I was in Greenville, South Carolina. It was time for me to pick up my yellow chip. When I was packing my clothes, I packed my yellow sweater, my yellow shirt, my yellow pants, my yellow socks. And I was going to get my yellow chip. Man, I was going to be a dude. Wade Hampton Group was a meeting I went to on Wednesday night, and that was my 6 month anniversary. And I went over to the Wade Hampton route, and I noticed there weren't any cars in the parking lot. And I thought, well, maybe it's just going to be a late start or something. Went up and pulled on the church door, and the door was locked. See, God in his infinite wisdom had moved that meeting that night. He knew this egotistical so-and-so didn't have no business picking up no chips that night. I went back to the hotel, and I was very upset. And then finally I realized what a real ass I was. And I got down on my knees and asked God to give me humility, and I have to do a whole lot of that. And I have to do it today just as much as I had to do it back then. And then at the end of 9 months, it was Christmas time in our house, and I was going to impress my friends in AA and let them know how good I was doing. So I went over here in a friend with the Mall of Vinnie's, and I bought Mama a fur coat. And I gave him all the money I had, and I owed him a bunch of money. And we made it up with my little girl down here and my son, and we were going to surprise Mama on Christmas morning. So we had that fur coat hid way back in the back of the closet, and we opened up all the other presents, and I gave them the sign, and they went to get it. And boy, we had really built us up a scenario, you know, how wonderful this was going to be. They brought the fur coat out. My Ellen and I took one look at it and said, "What the hell is that?" And I thought to myself, that woman ought to know a fur coat when she sees one. Make a long story short, she was not happy. So it was Christmas morning, and I didn't know one place to go, so I jumped in my old hippie van and drove over to Napa for 11 o'clock meeting, and I went in over there, and they said, "Anybody got anything they want to talk about?" "What do you want to talk about?" I said, "I want to tell you about this ungrateful bitch I got living at my house." You know what they did? Same thing y'all did. They laughed at me. Made me so damn mad I couldn't see straight. Two of them took me downstairs in a private room and said, "Boy, you are sick." Make a long story short, Avani took that Virgo back and gave me the money. Mama paid some of them bills we'd run up while I was drinking that liquor. And at the end of the year, Joe T. came over and told his story on my first birthday. Mama told me she loved me for the first time in a long time. She showed me she loved me for the first time in a long time. And I wish I could tell you everything was going well, but it wasn't. See, by now I'm out on the road and I'm traveling and I'm going to AA meetings all over the Southeast, and boy, I'm picking up all kinds of good stuff. And I became the biggest AA mockingbird you have ever heard in your life. I'd go out and take notes, and then I'd come back to my home group on Friday night, and I couldn't wait to share. And I'd share some of that good stuff. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about, but I'd share some of that good stuff. And I know now they're punching each other and say, Ernie's been out of town again. And you see, I was still doing the very same things I'd been doing when I was drinking liquor. I just wasn't drinking. I was still stealing money every month from my company. I was still lying. I was still cheating on my wife. I was still doing everything that I'd done when I was drinking. I just wasn't drinking. They tell you in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't have a head full of AA and a belly full of liquor, and you can't have a head full of AA and still do all that other stuff either, I tell you. It will eat you up. About 2.5, 3 years in this program, one day I was sitting at my kitchen table and I didn't know Mama was going to come in, and I was crying. She walked in from the grocery store and she put the bags down and she said, what in the world is wrong with you? I said, I don't know who I am. She said, by God, you don't want to know either. Black belt Al-Anon, boys. Still sick. Somewhere in between there and 5 years, I've been going to my home group every Friday night, and I've been going to the step study, and every time we got to the fourth and fifth step, I talked about how I needed to do another fourth and fifth step. And that's all I did, was talk about it. So we was at that time again, about 4.5 years in my sobriety, and I said, I really need to do another fourth and fifth step. And while I'm at it, I just can't understand why I ain't got any pigeons. You know, a guru like me ought to have people just, you know, sitting at my feet for me to share some of this good stuff with. After that meeting was over, the guy in our group over there, his name's Dennis S. A lot of y'all know Dennis. And see, Dennis, we knew Dennis had killed a man with his bare hands in California. Well, drunk or sober, I'm impressed by a man that kills a man with his bare hands. When that meeting was over that night, Dennis put me up against the wall and said, I got two things to tell you. And I said, yes, sir. Said, the first thing is, the reason you don't have any pigeons is because they don't want what you got. You are carrying the disease instead of the message. I said, yes, sir. He said, second thing is, you meet me in this parking lot Saturday morning at 9 o'clock and you do a four-step between now and then, we're going to do a fifth step. I said, yes, sir. So Saturday morning, bright and early, I met him out there. We went over to a little parking lot, got in the shade of a tree, got out of the car, got down on our knees, did the third step prayer, because he does it that way, and I believe that's the way it's supposed to be done. We got back in the car, and he said, okay, well, you know, I was a journalism major, and I had written a beautiful epistle. And I commenced to rationalize and justify everything I'd done for 27 years and tell him how I'd gotten the bad end of the stick and the world was out to get me. And about 3 minutes into it, he opened the door on his side and said, pardon me while I puke. I said, sir? He said, you go home, you read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you do it the way it's done in there, and you come back next Saturday morning, we'll do this again. I said, yes, sir. I did. And I did at that time the best, fourth and fifth step I could do at that time. And then came the moment of truth, because when we got done, he said, now, you've told me about all that stuff, but I hadn't heard anything about since you've been sober. He said, now tell me about the things that you've done since you've been sober. Ooh, I didn't want to do that. But I did. It wasn't easy. It was very difficult, because I wasn't, when you're drunk, you can say, well, I was a little drunk at the time. But I've been sober and done all these things. And when I got done, he gave me the best advice I've ever got. He looked at me right dead square in the eye and said, let the last time be the last time. Let the last time be the last time. And I can tell you, as God is my witness, the things we talked about that day, the last time was the last time. And that's the best advice I ever got. It was long about this time that Helen called me one morning and told me John was sick, that he had incurable cancer. I was really shaken. I got in my clothes, went over to Northside Hospital to see John, and I was going to cheer him up. And I walked in, he said, what meet did you go to last night? I said, I went to Scotland. He said, tell me about it. And I told him about it. He said, ain't it wonderful to have the God-given program of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life? I said, boy, it sure is, John. I walked out there so cheered up, I couldn't stand it. I went to cheer him up. He's dying, and he cheered me up. And that's the way it happened. And John was in and out of the hospital, and finally went in for that last time, and everybody knew it was going to be the last time. And I started going by to see him every Sunday before I'd go out of town, because I knew one Sunday was going to be the last time I saw him. And I'll never forget that last conversation I had with old John Burley, and he's in that other room now, so it's all right for me to break his anonymity. I said, John, how you doing? And the closest he ever came to complaining was, he said, Ernie, I'm just a little tired. I'm just a little tired. He never bitched about why me. He never talked about the odds. He always talked to me about, you know, I don't know if I could do this if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding. And God took John on that Thursday afternoon. He went to the other room. And I know he and Joe H. and Doc and all of them are having a hell of a time up there right now. But I was so mad I couldn't stand it, because God had taken my sponsor. And this gentleman right over here got a hold of me one night at a meeting. Old John H. got a hold of me because I was spewing and spouting all this stuff. And he said, Ernie, you never seen this God-given program work until you see somebody that really works it. Go to the other room. And I realized today that John Burley gave me the greatest object lesson he could possibly give me, because he showed me how to face God, the life's greatest adversity, death, with dignity and with faith in a power greater than himself. And every time I think about old John, I think, you know, there ain't nothing coming down the pike today that I can't handle with dignity and with faith if old John could look old death square in the eye. And I shall always be grateful for that. Oh, two little girls that I told you about today, we have a wonderful, wonderful relationship. The oldest one wouldn't have anything to do with me for a long time. You see, she'd written me a poem on her 16th birthday. And I'd been too drunk or too much of a big shot or too guilty or too whatever to go over there on Christmas of her 16th. Not a birthday, but on Christmas. And she didn't give me that poem until I was 5 years sober. And I knew when she gave me that poem that she had finally believed that I was trying to do something about my life. She's given me three wonderful grandchildren. My middle little girl's giving me another little boy type grandchild. They let me keep those kids all by myself. All by myself. That don't sound like much, does it? That's a hell of a big deal for a drunk. They let me keep those kids all by myself. Little girl sitting down here came into our life, and I love her very much. She's one of my biggest character defects today. I don't give her anything she doesn't want. But she knows how much I love her, and she knows how much she's meant to me in sobriety. And that big boy that I was going to do all those things with, when I finally got sober, I had an opportunity to do them. And we've been to ball games, we've been fishing, we've been hunting, we've done all those things. And in March of a year ago, he found a little lady just like Mama. Beautiful, smart, wonderful little lady. He asked her to marry. Took me out to lunch one day, and I didn't know anything about it. Took me out to lunch one day, said, Daddy, I'm going to get married. And I said, that's great. He said, Daddy, I want you to be my best man. I cried. See, there's two things I'll do today that I wish I would never do. One is crying front of other people, and other ones pray in front of other people. Don't bother me to pray in front of other people. Don't bother me to cry in front of them. We hugged next, and he let me be his best man. See, that was the first one of my kids' marriages I got to participate in. That's a big deal for me. But you see, that big boy, when he was growing up, every time those other boys would come into the house, every time he came and left, he would hug my neck and tell me he loved me. I don't know how he did it. I could have never done that. Big strapping boy walk up to me and hug my neck and tell me he loved me. That meant so much to me. I don't know how many of y'all have seen the movie The Field of Dreams. Before I get to that, let me tell you about Mama. Let me tell you about Mama. Mama is a very wonderful, special person. I love Mama with all my heart. She's prettier today than she was the first time I ever saw her, and she's the most beautiful woman I ever saw then. Now, I ain't going to tell you no lies. You know, am I going to tell you that everything is wonderful all the time at our house? Hell no, I'm not. Am I going to tell you we don't ever have a crossword? Hell no, I am not. But I'm going to tell you this. Today, Mama's working a program called Al-Anon, and I'm trying to work one called Alcoholics Anonymous. And we heard something down in Hilton Head Island several years ago where a guy said that you're not ever going to agree on everything, but if you'll just hold hands and face the same direction, things will work out. And you see, Mama and I are holding hands and facing the same direction today. We're heading in the same direction. And we got two entirely different ideas about how we're going to get there. But we're facing the same direction. And you can make it like that. You can make it like that. Close, I'd like to tell you about a movie my boy and I saw. I don't know whether you saw The Field of Dreams. It's a great movie. It's a great movie to see with your son. If you got a son, I recommend you get it from the movie place and you sit down and see it together. We went to see that movie, and it's my story in a way, because Kevin Costner plays a guy that had a hard time with his dad. His mom and dad got a divorce, and they went their separate ways, and he grew up, and he got married and had kids, moved out on this farm out in Kansas someplace, and all of a sudden he started getting this vision and said, build it and they will come. Build it and they will come. Well, you know what it was for a while, and then finally it dawned on him, he's supposed to build a baseball field. So he went out in the middle of a cornfield and he builds this beautiful baseball field with bleachers and lights and bases and everything, and the neighbors think he's batshit crazy or drunk. And then all of a sudden, from out of the corn patch start coming these Major League Baseball players from the other room that have gone to the other room. Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, some of those guys. And his daddy had been a Major League Baseball player. And he came out. And Kevin was very hesitant, but he walked up to him and he said, Daddy, tell me. He said, where you been? And he said, son, I've been to heaven. And he said, Daddy, tell me, what's it like? He said, son, it's a place where dreams come true. I looked over at my boy, and I sure was glad he was crying because I was squalling. And I hugged his neck, and he hugged my neck. And we went out and had one of the best two-hour conversations you've ever seen after that. And we told each other how much we loved each other and how much we wanted for each other. And I thought, and I told him that day, I said, you know, I wish I could see my daddy again. And I can just imagine he'd walk up to me and he'd say, Ernie, I understand you're not drinking anymore. And I'd say, Daddy, by the grace of God, I ain't drank today, one day at a time. And he'd say, son, how'd you do it? And I'd say, Daddy, I found a group of people called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd say, son, what's it like? And I'd say, Daddy, it's a place where for folks like you and me, dreams really can come true. God bless you. Thank you.